All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Happy Friday, everybody. I'm NPR Chief Meteorologist Paul Huttner in for Angela Davis today with a special edition of ClimateCast. All month long, we've been collecting your questions about climate change science, impacts, and solutions. And today we have a great team of climate reporters and experts to try and answer as many as we can. And if you want to get in and ask a question on the air, here's the number to call, 651-227-6000, or you can reach us at 800-242-2828. Great team today. NPR News environment reporter Elizabeth Dunbar is here, and much of her work focuses on climate change impacts here in Minnesota. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Paul.
And Minnesota senior climatologist with the DNR, Kenny Blumenfeld, is here. Kenny works on many aspects of climate science, including the trends we're seeing right here in Minnesota. Hi, Kenny.
Hi, Paul.
Good to have you back. Elizabeth, let's start with you and this Climate Question project you've been involved in. What does the project involve?
Well, we're collecting questions from anyone. So you can go to NPRnews.org/climate, and there's a place where you can add your question. And basically, people have been writing in and just telling us what they're curious about when it comes to climate change. And we're collecting those, and we're having people vote on them to see which ones they want us to answer first. And we're kind of going through, and some of them are very complicated questions, and other of them are easier to answer. So we're going through and trying to answer them as quickly as we can.
So as you go through all these, they are great questions. Is there a theme or anything that jumps out at you about the nature of these questions?
We've gotten a lot of questions about what can I do as an individual about climate change? And that is a tough question. And I'm going to be answering that probably next week a little bit more. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about it today. But then there's all just a range of things about how do we adapt to the changes that are already happening versus what can we do to reduce our emissions.
And we will talk about what folks can do today. Kenny, I'm curious about people you meet in your life, right? They find out what you do for a living. What are the most common kinds of questions people ask you about climate change?
Honestly, I'd say that the most common questions are, well, is it real? Are we in big trouble? And, you know, do you really believe this stuff? Those are kind of, you know, until someone knows what a climatologist does, they often will make assumptions that we're some kind of advocate or activist, or that, you know, we came in to prove a particular point, or that, you know, we're just there to say, you can't know anything. So, those are kind of at first what people say. But once they find out what we do as climatologists, their questions change a bit.
Well, we've got a lot of questions from NPR listeners today. So let's do it this way, you guys. We'll hear a question from an NPR listener, and between the three of us, we'll try to provide some answers and context, okay?
Sounds good.
All right. First, though, I want to hear from Mark Seeley. This was one listener question from a listener named Rich about the difference between climate and weather. And here's what University of Minnesota climatologist Mark Seeley said with Tom Cran earlier this week.
From a scientific standpoint, weather is the state of the atmosphere now. Climate is a history of that weather dynamic. It is also the geographic distribution of that.
So, as both a climatologist and a meteorologist, what do you think when you hear things like people say, you know, you get 20 below and a foot of snow, and they go, well, so much for climate change? Or if it's a terribly warm stretch in the summer, everyone's like, oh, this is undoubtedly climate change. Are either of those true?
I like to use a common analogy, and that's a man or woman walking a dog. Okay, when you walk a dog, you're going from point A to point B. Mm-hmm. But depending on the length of the leash, the dog's going to wander all over the place, maybe chase a squirrel whereas you maintain that trajectory. That's kind of analogous to what the weather does. The weather roams or varies moment to moment, day to day, but the climate trajectory is a totally different thing. Maybe it's warming, or maybe it's more precipitation. Those are the two climate trends or pathways, points A to B, we're seeing in Minnesota.
And always a great answer from Mark Seely on climate versus weather. Kenny, you get that a lot. What's your perspective?
I mean, you can't say it much better than Mark Seely says it. But, you know, I guess one thing that I think people here, they intuit that our climate is inherently wild, right? I mean, we have extremes built into what we experience here. So we get very cold, we get very hot, we get wet, we get dry, and we can do that all within 1 year, or we can have 1 year that's somewhat different from what you'd expect. And that's kind of the variability that everyone sort of understands intuitively, even if they never think of it as variability. And at the same time, we have measured trends, so we know where we're going. It's not that every single year is warmer than the last year, or that every single year is even warmer than average. It's that we have this tendency to be warmer. We have this tendency to be wetter. And so it's actually not just possible, but it's required that we have both. We have both the variability that's inherent to our climate that we'll always have, and that we can also have these trends that we have seen. And one does not contradict the other at all. They don't disprove each other, and they don't prove each other. The weather moments, those exciting, highly variable moments, are part of our climate, and they're not separate from it at all.
And I love that dog walking analogy, because I try to think of it as walking on the beach. So you see the human footprints, and they're pretty much going in a straight line. But the dog paws are going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So that's weather. The climate keeps marching straight forward. All right, let's get to some more listener questions. Mina has a question about standing water and crops this year.
My name is Mina Learwood, and my question is, how extensive is crop failure in Minnesota and the Midwest due to flooding and extra wet conditions? I've seen a lot of standing water in the cornfields. How unusual is this?
And Kenny and Elizabeth, I took a trip out west to Lacaparal Lake a couple of weeks ago, and driving across Minnesota, there is water in fields in every county that I drove through. So I've never seen that much water. Kenny, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we're in a very wet period. So we try talking to people about this because we go out into rural parts of Minnesota, and it's been incredibly wet. And we have to remember, it's not just this year. One of the things that we were, unfortunately, and we might be looking at it again, is we went into last winter with really wet soils. So then the soils froze up, and most of us have forgotten that really, we didn't get much of a winter, December into about mid-January. Mm-hmm. And we were looking okay, and all that sort of highly saturated, frozen soils weren't going to pose a problem. But then we got, beginning in late January, and especially February and March, we got a lot of precipitation, a big snowpack on top of that. And so then when that all melted, that just added, with the thaw of the frozen soils, that just added to the amount of moisture on the ground. And as it continued to rain after that, we just ended up with too much, and it hasn't really let up. But this is a few years in
a
row.
It's a few years. It's not just 1 year.
Right. This is actually going to go down. Most of Minnesota, I don't think northern Minnesota, but most of the rest of the state, it's going to be the wettest decade on record. And a lot of that's been punctuated by the most recent 4, 5, 6 years, where it's just been unlike anything we'd really observed. So we are seeing more water on the land, and we are seeing problems with that.
Elizabeth, ag is part of your beat. You talk to a lot of farmers in Minnesota. Is this a recurring theme that you're hearing about?
Absolutely. But I would agree with Kenny that it's not just this year. And I think one thing that we'll look at is the harvest. A lot of farmers mm-hmm. are just starting to harvest their crops, and then we'll really know sort of what the impact was this year.
All right, here's Mike with a question about what kind of trees should I plant?
My name is Mike Larson, and I live near Ellsworth, Wisconsin. So my question is, what type of trees are best to plant in our region to capture the most amount of carbon? We have a small hobby farm, and we have the ability to plant some trees. I'm just wondering what the best kind to plant are for our region.
Elizabeth, you've done some work there.
Yes, I looked into this one, and I reached out to Eli Sagar at the Cloquet Forestry Center, University of Minnesota Extension, and he had this great phrase in his email to me, which I'm using, which is, wood is good. And so he said it really depends on where you live and the type of soil you have, whether you're able to protect the trees from deer. Deer eat small trees. And so, you know, he wasn't willing to put forth like a specific species, but he said the faster growing tree, the better. And if you've got woodlands on your land where there's just lots of trees growing, if you thin those out so that you give space so that some of those trees can grow faster, then the more wood that they put on, they're storing carbon from the atmosphere, and that's good for the climate.
Mary has a question about climate change and, oh, get this, weather forecasting.
Hi, this is Mary Dalbunnel. I'm from Cottage Grove, Minnesota, and my climate change question is, how is climate change affecting the ability of meteorologists to accurately predict the weather?
Well, I'm happy to jump in on that one. Thank you, Mary. There are a couple things that we see as weather forecasters and a person who practices forecasting on a daily basis. And one of them has to do with this Arctic amplification theory, the theory that the Arctic is warming much faster than the equator, and that that's causing changes in our jet stream. It's slowing down, it's getting loopier, and we do start to see that on the weather maps from day to day. And so weather patterns slow down, storms get stuck, patterns get stuck. We tend to get more consistent, heavier rainfall events in some parts of the country, and more persistent droughts in other parts of the country. So that is one area, I think, where it's evolving kind of right in front of us every day. Kenny, do you have any perspective on that?
I mean, it's a really interesting question. And I guess I was going to ask you, or at least, you know, kind of bring it up for conversation, this notion that our systems get stuck. Maybe listeners know the kinds of weather models we use really are good for, you know, maybe up to 6 or 7 days. They can give you some information, but you can't really trust the details out to about 10 days. And then once you get beyond 10 days, they're kind of going with the prevailing pattern. And one of the things that I think Paul was getting at is that they can't necessarily see how stuck a pattern is going to be. So if you have a big trough over the western United States, the models will often just kind of move it through like
right.
normal. And then you've observed that that's not necessarily what happens.
Yeah, it's I mean, you talk about the trends of Minnesota getting wetter. Well, part of that is perhaps weather systems are hanging around longer and there's more moisture in the atmosphere. So the systems are producing heavier rain. We know 1 degree increase Fahrenheit causes the atmosphere to hold about 4 to 5% more water vapor. And folks like Kevin Trenberth at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado have done studies on hurricanes like Harvey and been able to document that extra water vapor into as much as a 20 or 30% increase in rainfall out of that system, that and a warmer ocean. So, yes, I think the answer is climate change is affecting weather forecasting and weather patterns, but we don't yet know exactly how that's all unfolding regionally. Let's grab a call from Paul in St. Paul. Good morning, Paul. What's your question?
Good morning. Thanks for having me. It seems that going to a plant-based diet or more of a plant-based diet, less meat would have an impact. It seems that I heard a statistic that over 40% of the land in the United States is dedicated to animal raising, raising crops for them or for meat, and also just the impact of methane on the ozone layer. I was curious as to what your guests would have to say about something that, since you said you're concerned about what we could do, it seems eating less meat would be a very straightforward suggestion to influence the climate.
Great question, Paul. Thank you so much. Elizabeth, your thoughts there?
Yeah, that's a complicated question, and it's a controversial one, honestly, because it involves personal choices. And, you know, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about Minnesota's emissions. Agriculture accounts is one of the top three sources of greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. Animal agriculture is a part of that. And then you have to also look at the crops. And a lot of the crops that we're growing here in Minnesota are used to feed animals. But then if you ask the farmers, okay, well, Minnesota farmers would point out, okay, if we're not going to grow crops to feed animals, or if we're not going to raise animals here in Minnesota, where are we going to raise them? Brazil. And Brazil is a huge soybean producer. And the concern there is deforestation, is turning rainforests and forests into row crop farming. And so it is a complicated question and answer in terms of how do we reduce this? And I bet Kenny has some to add.
Yeah. And for people that do want to make choices, I mean, they've done the math, right? And things like chicken are a much more climate friendly choice, it turns out, at least from what I've found out. Kenny, what's your perspective there?
So one thing, you know, it's hard to keep up with all the news, right? And it's even hard to keep up with the climate news. And people may have missed that there was kind of a blockbuster report in 2019 from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that really got around the issue of the relationship between agriculture and other land uses and the changing climate. And this is always difficult for scientists because they end up with, you know, not necessarily becoming policy advocates, but they had to sort of say, well, here's what it would take to change. And really to get us away from the trajectory we're on, the scientists were recommending a more plant-based diet. But to this notion, you know, we often think it has to be binary, that you're either eating meat or you're a vegetarian or you're a vegan. And there's actually a whole gradient in between. And now this, I should mention, this is not what the DNR necessarily pays me to talk about, but it's something that comes up in a lot of the conversations that we have. So as you mentioned, there are types of meat where the emissions intensiveness is less or more based on the type of agriculture that's involved. And you can always just trade something out. So you could, for example, just trade a hamburger for a piece of chicken, or you could just sort of step down that. So it doesn't have to be a kind of all or nothing as people get used to the choices they make. But the caller is correct that a more plant-based diet was actually what was recommended by the world's leading scientists in terms of what would be required to kind of bend the curve a bit.
And just so we get perspective on the breakdown here, right? We know transportation and electric power generation are the two biggest sources of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Ag is third, is that correct,
In Minnesota, it's really those three are very close: transportation, electricity, and agriculture. And electricity is going down. We know that we're getting away from fossil fuels. Coal plants are going to be retiring. And so really the two that we're focusing on in Minnesota, one is transportation. If you look at the policies that are happening with that, there's a lot more happening in transportation. Ag is just harder. It's a harder nut to crack.
All right, let's take another phone call. Catherine in Northeast Minneapolis. Good morning. What's your question?
Great. Well, my name is Catherine. I live in Northeast in a townhouse. And downtown and Northeast and Baudieu and other places, we have a lot of townhouses, high-rise apartment buildings. And my question is, what can a person who either owns or rents in these dense multi-unit places do to lessen impact on climate or promote good climate practices? Because, I mean, I can't put solar panels on my roof. I can't put out a rain barrel. I do use wind energy. I buy organic coffee. But, you know, we are really limited by what either the management company or the board of directors is willing to do. And in our case, we just permanently removed two of our perennial gardens, which I objected to. So, you know, what kinds of things can we do? And I'm going to put a shout out and hope you put up the link to the Nobel conference at Gustavus that was just this week on climate change. So thanks much.
Thank you, Catherine. Kenny Blumenfeld, what do you think?
Okay, so again, this is not necessarily in my professional expertise, but something that comes up in a lot of the meetings that we go to. So great work already, and it's great that you're interested in this. There's, in terms of sort of being at the mercy of another entity, it does all then come down to what are personal choices. So anything from, you know, we can always remember Did we turn all the lights off? Are we using the most efficient lights possible? Are we doing what we can to, are we sealing our windows in the wintertime so that it's not so drafty, so we don't require so much heat, whether we pay for it or someone else does? It's still energy that's being consumed, and those are greenhouse gases that are usually going into the atmosphere to generate that energy. We also have, things like, are we reusing? Are we reducing our consumption? Are we buying used when we could buy new, or buying new when we could buy used? We want to, anything that we do that limits the amount of manufacturing, unfortunately, that's kind of one of the realities of this, is if we can reduce what we are buying new, or that's requiring the creation of new materials, then we're going to reduce the footprint of that particular activity. So there's a lot that we can do. And are we driving when we could walk? Are we driving when we could bike? Are we, are we doing what we can to shut our computers off at night? Things like that. I mean, it's small things, but it's really the folks who are already on board and willing and interested in doing this. It's like, well, we have to be doing it then.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, I was just going to say that the caller mentioned energy, and they're not able to put solar panels on their townhouse. But there are other ways that you can invest in renewable energy. There's community solar gardens that kind of offset whatever you're using wherever you live, even if it's an apartment and you're a renter. And so, some people have decided that they want to take these individual actions. The other thing I would say is that electricity is moving in that direction.
Mm-hmm.
A larger and larger percentage of our electricity is coming from renewable sources, and that's just going to continue to change.
And on my part, full disclosure, how I kind of walk the talk on climate is, I'm fortunate, a couple of things. One, I do the wind source program with Xcel, so 100% of my home electric power comes from wind. NPR also allows me, has set me up to digitally commute for most of my work. So I'm usually making the commuting trip one day a week, maybe two. So I've been able to reduce my transportation commuting footprint by about 60 to 80%. If that's something you can ask your employer about, that's a pretty big structural way to make a change in your transportation emissions. And we know that that's the biggest part of most transportation of emissions is through commuting. So interesting stuff there. You guys, this week, yesterday, I had Richard Alley in the studio from Penn State. He's a climate scientist there. We've had a lot of questions about, just where are the predictions for climate change tracking from where they were 20, 30, 40 years ago. And I asked Richard to answer that question from Ireland.
A whole lot of the things that were predicted 30 years ago are happening. And just a slight aside, what was done 30 years ago, what is still done, is that the climate scientists say, we will guess what humans decide. They may put up a lot of CO2, they may not put up as much.
Right.
We'll run a future for a little bit, and then you see which today is similar to what was projected 30 years ago. When you get that, what you find is the projections were pretty much right on global mean surface temperature, on increase in water vapor in the atmosphere, on the rise in the most intense rainfall with the warming, on warming of nights being very strong in many places, on melting of sea ice. So a number of things are tracking just the way we expected, and the accuracy is really impressive. Sea level rise has been a little faster than we expected. It's right at the upper limit of what things had said, so you could say it was a successful one, but it tends to be running a little on the high side.
Richard Alley there, ladies and gentlemen, from Penn State. He's great. Kenny, Minnesota, how are we tracking, with the data? I'm talking about observed data versus future modeling, and I think people get confused about that. So how are we tracking in Minnesota from what we've actually observed?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think that, Dr. Alley's talking about basically the global projections, and he's right. It's really within tenths of a degree Celsius that even the early projections had us, they're within tenths of a degree Celsius to where we are now, depending on which model you're talking about, which generation of models you're talking about. Where it gets a little tricky is when you look at specific regions. And what the earliest models, we only had a theory for it. initially, which was that, well, we understand that greenhouse gases absorb heat, and we understand that the majority of heat is lost during the wintertime and at night and in regions that have kind of strong winters and strong nights. And so we had a notion that, well, maybe the warming will be faster in places like Minnesota. But I think that Minnesota's warmed a lot faster than the global average, and we've seen a lot of that warming in you know, the wintertime especially. And so in that way, we're now learning more about how these local regions are, I guess, differentially affected by the changes in the global climate. Minnesota's warmed faster than we would have expected, but back then we didn't have the models that could help us understand that. Now that we do, we see that the kind of warming we've observed in Minnesota, you know, generally we're tracking just under a half a degree Fahrenheit per decade right now. That's kind of what we're seeing projected for the next several decades, assuming that we kind of stay on the same greenhouse gas emissions pathway that we're on. So we've started to see an alignment of the observations and the modeling.
And if we quantify that, am I close by saying Minnesota is roughly 5 degrees warmer in winter since about 1970? And are we about 5 inches wetter than we were?
Those are both pretty close. I'd say for statewide average precipitation, it might be closer to three and three quarters inches. But in parts of southern and eastern Minnesota, it's more like 6 inches wetter.
And that's significant, Paul. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it really is, because what we're talking about is averages here. You have to remember that this is averages over a period of time. And when we measure these, you know, those are actual changes.
And I always like to make the point that, you know, we've built our societies, for example, farmers grow crops under a certain set of climatic assumptions that we've had in the past, right? When you start goosing it, when you start tweaking it, those assumptions no longer apply. And it goes to urban infrastructure, too. We're getting these heavier rainfall events. Storm sewers are only so big. They can only handle so much runoff, right? So when you supercharge those storms and the runoff, you're overwhelming that urban infrastructure. That costs money to repair. And interesting to note that, because here's Kate, who wrote in a question about the costs of climate change.
My name is Kate Knuth. I live in Minneapolis. And my question is, how much will climate impacts and adapting to climate change cost?
Great question. We touched on it. Elizabeth, do you have any thoughts on that?
I cannot answer the how much, but I'm going to just point out a few things that to think about.
Mm-hmm.
One is public health. So how does the greenhouse gas emissions, the increased emissions, and then the warming exacerbate air pollution, for example? And then how is that impacting people with asthma or other respiratory conditions? Another cost that you just mentioned, Paul, was like the infrastructure. Do we have to build bigger culverts and things like that? That's another thing to think about. You know, the sea level rise, moving communities. There's just a lot of different costs. And Kenny knows a lot more about the specifics.
Well, I mean, I think one way we can kind of wrap our heads around this is, we've all gone across Minnesota during the summertime, right? So we know the agony of driving through a massive construction zone. And when we talk to the engineers who are planning and designing the roads, and they're saying, well, if it's raining this much more, we need bigger culverts, or we need to change the way that the road is actually constructed. And often we need to tear up the road. For even just a quarter mile or a mile of one of these projects, it can be tens of millions of dollars, because you have to account for the materials, the time, the labor, the equipment, and whatever else goes into contracting one of those. And also, you know, sometimes you have land easement type negotiations between the different agencies if you're actually widening the road. And so it's a pretty substantial investment. And these are the sorts of things we're starting to see needed across much of the state. So it's hard to quantify, but once you get into that transportation infrastructure part, that's where probably our largest direct costs appear to be. And it's a big number.
You know, we touched on this a little bit in the last half hour, you guys. How do I talk to skeptics? And, you know, I think of data versus values and how people make decisions. By the way, there's a great website called skepticalscience.com that details all of the sort of myths about climate change and answers them with peer-reviewed climate science. So it's a great resource for anybody who's looking for answers to those many myths, like the climate has changed before, that kind of thing. Skepticalscience.com. Kenny, how do you talk to the skeptics?
Well, I think one of the keys is to maybe not refer to them as skeptics.
Is that a fair description? Because there is debate about that in our profession and in journalism.
I think that we need to move beyond it, honestly. I think that so Yale and George Mason University have been embarking on this climate communication project for years now. And they've identified a kind of a spectrum where on sort of the accepting side and maybe really forced into action, you have alarmed.
The six Americas of climate change. Yes. Everything from dismissive all the way to concerned and alarmed.
Right. And right. I think that if we just call it skeptical, we're not really getting at what's going on there. And, you know, I actually have to do work and talk about these same things in areas where people maybe aren't as on board with some of the messaging. And you still want to have the same conversation because all the things that we're talking about here, all the things that Elizabeth has reported on for ag and climate, and all of the things that we've just discussed are still valid out in areas that maybe aren't as, don't have the same political makeup as you find in the Twin Cities. They still are having heavy rains. They're still having shorter winters. They're seeing more precipitation. They have water on their fields. And for me, the trick has been, you know, yes, we do want to rely on facts and science when possible, but we also want to meet people where they are and have the conversation that they're ready to have. And that, to me, has been, well, you know, if we've got anecdotes about what a long winter or a short winter looks like or a long growing season looks like, and it's something that you can relate to, then you're much more likely to connect that anecdote back to the data that I'm talking about. And so it's been, for me anyway, it's the best successes I've had is just to kind of let people tell their stories and see if we can sort of map those stories to the same trend lines that I've got graphs showing. And I think we've had a lot of success with that. And it's been a lot less of kind of pushing facts down people's throats and telling them that they're wrong if they don't understand this. It kind of has to be a conversation with someone, and you have to kind of care about what their response is.
Elizabeth?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, I get a lot of questions from listeners. Well, you know, how do I convince my mom, or how do I, you know, convince somebody that this is actually happening? And maybe that's the wrong goal. Maybe that's the wrong thing to focus on. I think coming at a conversation with somebody that is skeptical about climate science is more just about, okay, understanding where they're coming from and why, and understanding what their general concerns are and focusing on that. And then, you know, relating it to things that are other things that they care about, you know, just understanding people's values, I think is really useful, and developing some curiosity and some empathy is, I think, one way to go.
Kenny, you mentioned the Yale George Mason studies, and those numbers are interesting because they've been moving. In the last 5 years, the percentage of alarmed and concerned Americans has risen to 59%. And the dismissive part, the people that completely dismiss climate change, is only about 9%. That's a pretty significant shift in the past 5 years. So we do see opinion shifting.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And I think that probably has to do as much with people's own experiences or the kind of going at their own speed. So, you know, listeners should know that it's sort of those that alarmed and alarmed and accepting. Mm-hmm. Those are the two sort of ideals, right?
Concerned and alarmed.
Yeah, concerned and alarmed. Two. That's kind of where the scientists assume we should be if we actually want to see some progress. So it's nice that we're making progress along those lines. And I think, you know, the kind of empathy that Elizabeth talked about, then combined with facts, as you mentioned, the Skeptical Science website is a good way to kind of arm yourself with facts so that you can have that empathic conversation. But, you know, I think we maybe lost a decade or two where we were just kind of shooting facts back and forth across the table. And it's like, the world's getting warmer and you have to do something about it. Well, it's not really getting warmer. And we had this kind of a wheel spinning debate that maybe didn't really consider how we process information in a positive way. And I think some of the research is now starting to get at that.
And, you know, one of the reasons we do ClimateCast here, at least I do, is to talk about solutions, because there are solutions to climate change, and many of those solutions have positive benefits, jobs, economic benefits. Kenny, just quickly, too, you mentioned the scientist Stuart from St. Paul had to go, but asks about that 98% climate scientist acceptance rate of the science. What do we know about that number? You're smiling.
Yeah, I think of the people who understand how the atmosphere works and do active research on the atmosphere or the integrated Earth system, it is close to 100% that actually understand, okay, the carbon dioxide, methane, water vapor are greenhouse gases. The greenhouse gases absorb outgoing radiation. In other words, they absorb heat and they increase the temperature of the Earth just sort of by virtue of what they do naturally, and that we have increased their concentrations and that has further increased the temperature of the Earth. Nobody's disputing that. There aren't any credible scientific studies coming out in any year that dispute that. And so we're right at 100% or very near 100%. And there's not a lot there. Where the debate always ends up being is, well, the amount of warming that you can attribute. But nobody's actually wholesale denying that these greenhouse gases cause the planet to warm. And the fact is, if anyone does deny it, they're really not valid participants in that debate.
Yeah, and you know what? It's really pretty simple at this level. We're changing the chemistry of the atmosphere. And when you change the chemistry of the atmosphere, you change the physical response of the atmosphere. That's pretty basic chemistry and physics. Let's go to Josh in Anoka. Josh, good morning. What's your question?
Good morning. So I'm a graduate student at Stevens Point, and I'm studying the adaptive capacity of coastal communities on the Great Lakes to respond to climate change. And I've been doing some research, and a bunch of the studies out right now are kind of inconsistent talking about if the Great Lakes levels are going to rise or not. So I was wondering if you guys know anything about that or have anything to say.
Great question, Josh. Kenny, I know one of your compatriots, Jay Austin, up in University of Minnesota Duluth, and other folks are studying that. What's your perspective there?
I mean, currently the Great Lakes are rising, and Lake Superior in particular is rising. But I think we have to be careful. This is something that we talk about. We also have to admit where there are elements of this system that we have some uncertainty mm-hmm. remaining. We'd only have to go back about 10 years where we were pretty sure that the signal for climate change in the Great Lakes was going to be a reduction in lake level because the upper Midwest had been in a somewhat dry spell, and so we had more evaporation, and so the lake levels were going down. And this is an area where we just have to be careful. I would certainly defer to Jay, but I think we have to be careful to understand what of this is just variability and we're going to continue to have ups and downs versus which of it is an actual trend that is consistently tied to the increases in greenhouse gases and then the warming effect that they have on the globe. Those are questions that we really need to be careful as we address.
And the regional aspects of this are still unfolding. Elizabeth, I want to talk about energy for a second with you. Catherine asks about energy companies, programs like wind energy that I use. Are they actually creating more demand, shifting demand, or is that just sort of a marketing thing?
I think it depends on the program, but, you know, in general, there are opt-in programs for consumers to do. Wind sources, one through Xcel Energy. There's community solar gardens. So there are these options, and they do contribute to this transition. How much is probably a difficult question to answer. But then also, you know, you have to remember that this transition is happening independent of that as well. And so, you know, if you're a consumer and you're wondering, well, should I do community solar? Should I do this or should I do that? I think it really depends on how much detail you want to have as a consumer about where your electricity is coming from. And if you are really serious about that, then I would say absolutely look into these programs. But you can also, as a consumer, do other things with efficiency and in, you know, putting pressure on your utility to adopt some of these things. So there's multiple ways to get at that.
Efficiency is low-hanging fruit. There are some studies that have come out that says maybe there's a 40% greenhouse gas reduction opportunity right there. So that's a really good point. And, you know, I do want to see if we can get a couple more callers in if there's time. So give us a shout, 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828 is the number to call. Kenny, we got this from Sonia. Earth's average temperature. What is it and how much is it moving? Now, I did a little work on this, 57 degrees in the 1951 to 80 time period, but it's gone up, what, about 1.6 Fahrenheit in the last 30 years?
Yeah, correct. It's sort of, as you pointed out, it definitely depends on that baseline. So we know that, you know, if we just account for the sunlight coming in, the sunlight going out, or the long wave radiation, the heat coming off of the Earth, and then the fact that we have an atmosphere, we've generally observed that average global temperature to be right around 57 degrees Fahrenheit, or what is that, about 14 degrees Celsius. And we've seen about a 1 degree Celsius, 1.5 to 2 degree Fahrenheit increase in those temperatures. Again, it kind of depends on the your frame of reference, but you can look at the curves. We're actually increasing it. I wouldn't quite call it exponential, but the rate has been increasing in the last few decades over what it had been in the previous decades. So it's a sharper rate of increase now, indicating that that rate of change would be different over, say, the next 50, 60, 70 years than it's been over the last 50, 60, 70 years.
And interesting to note, I think important to note, that the last 6 years now are the six warmest years on record in the global surface temperature record that goes back into the 1800s. This year looks like globally we'll come in at number two or number three, and that makes six out of six. Kenny, I always say, you know, a balanced climate system, we should be having a mix of above average and below average years. The climate system is really out of whack compared to average.
Yeah, you should have sort of a baseline, and then you go up and down relative to that baseline. But I think the point that you brought up also is a good opportunity to talk about why it's difficult to discuss some of these things, because we are not going to see one of the six warmest years on record in Minnesota, not by a long shot.
Sure.
In fact, the majority, I wouldn't be shocked if 2019 ends up on the negative side of the ledger, even if we use the historical average rather than the last 30 years. It's been, I wouldn't say it's been brutally cold, but we've been cool and wet by and large in Minnesota this year. And this is one of the challenges we have when we talk to people, right? Because we know that the globe is getting warmer, but people often relate to what's in their backyard.
Let's take another call. Harvey in Zumbrota, good morning. What is your question this morning?
Good morning. My question relates to how nuclear fits into the carbon-free electricity, since it is a good baseload.
Great question, Harvey. Elizabeth, what's your perspective there?
Yeah, I'll take that. You know, nuclear power is something that we do have in Minnesota right now. We've got two nuclear plants, one in Monticello and one in Prairie Island. Xcel owns both of those. But they are going to be getting older. And so the question is, do we keep running them because this is carbon-free electricity? Or do we transition to something else? And Harvey did refer to this idea of baseload power, which is this thing where you run a power plant, you know, all the time, and it's just always putting out power. And renewable energy is different, right? You got wind that goes up and down. You got solar, and obviously that's not producing electricity during the nighttime. The experts on this really point to changes in the grid. There's changes in storage. If you improve interconnectivity, that renewable energy can be like a baseload power source. So the thinking on baseload power and reliability has been shifting. And so we're going to probably see more of that in Minnesota.
And Elizabeth, I know you've done a lot of work in this area. I just spoke with Ben Folk, who's the CEO of Xcel Energy, in the last couple of days. We're going to air that interview next week. And he talks about nuclear, too, and some new varieties of nuclear, smaller plants that are coming out. So I think it's going to be interesting to see how they try to meet their carbon goals for 2050. He admits that the technology is there to get to about 80% carbon-free
right
now, but they've got to solve that last 20%.
Right, right. And, you know, nuclear is a great asset for them right now. It is able to be run all the time. And so they have this nuclear that's carbon-free, and then they are in a better position than some utilities that don't have nuclear to transition some of their coal plants out.
All right. Great concept. Nick in Bloomington has a question. Good morning, Nick. What's your question?
Yes, I was wondering about the sun cycles. I know it's got something like a 7 or 8 year cycle and then an even longer cycle than that. And I was wondering how that could play into the amount of heat we get.
Great question. Kenny, we do know something about solar cycles.
We do, and we're also learning more. And there's kind of one sort of edge of your seat thing to pay attention to. So the caller's correct. We do have solar cycles that vary basically on 7 to 13 year timeframes. And you can trace these back for decades and decades. And obviously, if the sun has more output, we tend to be a bit warmer. We also tend to get a little bit more electromagnetic activity. And we have been, you know, one of the questions that comes up is, well, maybe the warming that we've observed is because the sun has sort of gotten hotter. It's become more active. And actually, we've seen the opposite, that over time, there's been actually a small decrease in the solar constant, so its output should be leading us towards a bit of cooling, and this has to do with a number of factors. One of the things that's been published in the last couple of years that we find interesting and we need to watch for is that in sort of the new emerging science of solar predictions, there's some, I guess, interest in that perhaps we're moving into a solar minimum period. Mm-hmm. Now, this would have the effect, if it were true, if it actually happened, this would have the effect of cooling us down a bit. And I think one of the concerns that a lot of scientists have is how would you help the public differentiate between that kind of cooling and the sort of cooling you're hoping to achieve through emissions reductions? Because once you come out of that cycle, you'd be back where you started again. So that's an interesting thing to watch. But right now, the sun is actually being kind of overpowered by the greenhouse gases. So we're warming, even though the sun would indicate we should be cooling.
And that's important because they've done the math mm-hmm. on this, on solar forcing, volcanoes, all of right. these different impacts. And the CO2 is a much greater forcing mechanism in the atmosphere. You know, I want to get to this really quickly because people ask, you know, where are we going to be 2030, 2050 and beyond? Part of this comes down to risk assessment for the economics of climate change. There was a piece in the Insurance Journal recently. Swiss Re, the big reinsurance company, researched cat losses, $7 billion back in the 1970s to $143 billion a year in the 2010 to 2018 period. And we know there's increased climate change attribution to these individual extreme weather events and that risk models are changing for insurance companies. We just saw PG&E go bankrupt because of liability from the fires in California last year, sort of these black swan events. So, you know, this is a sort of a toss-up kind of question for you guys, but as we start to see these changes impact the way we live, what's the risk upside there, Elizabeth?
I think the risks are really unknown, and that there's just a lot of uncertainty to that. And also, you have to keep in mind that the more houses and the more stuff that we have, the more risk we're putting out there and could see potential losses. And so I think the one way that people are thinking about this in terms of mitigating that is to choose things that are more resilient. So how do we build buildings that can resist some of these events? Or, you know, how can we make sure that these heavy rains can go into permeable pavement instead of flooding our streets or things like that, so that we can just be ready for whatever the weather and the climate brings us.
And Kenny, that comes to smart design. We can build smarter cities and societies, right? The question is, can we do it quickly enough as the climate shifts?
Well, I think that the low-hanging fruit for all of this, I mean, we know, yes, we have uncertainty, but we also know some things are just given. So the sea level is rising, not only because of the input of more water from ice off of the land surfaces, but also because the sea expands with temperature. So the warmer sea has more volume, and so sea levels are higher. So obviously coastal communities and low-lying near-coastal communities are in significant jeopardy, and that's where a lot of the losses are coming. Here in Minnesota, you know, as bad as it seems, when we talk about extreme rainfall, and it is bad and it could be very expensive, we're really not what they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the massive increase in property losses from these giant storms, we're really talking about the Harveys and the Irmas and Marias and you name it, because we've got exposed near coastal and coastal communities that are increasingly vulnerable to these, some of these events, which are also, by the way, potentially becoming stronger too. So,
well, it's a great conversation. It's a great hour. Thanks to both of you, NPR News environment reporter Elizabeth Dunbar, NPR, or I should say Minnesota DNR senior climatologist Kenny Blumenfeld. And thanks to you for all of your great questions at home. That is ClimateCast for this week. I'm NPR meteorologist Paul Huttner. Make it a great Friday.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the conversation, you can call in at 651-227-6000 or tweet us at Angela Davis MPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@mpr.org.